It's the 21st of March 2014, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Was Fred Phelps a civil rights hero? How can we reconcile opposition to Leveson with this week's front pages? Are NASA over-egging their doom-mongering? And what happened at the Big Bang Fair? Now we start this week with the death of Fred Phelps, of the notorious Westboro Baptist Church. I think that even if Christianity were true, he'd probably be having a very awkward conversation with St. Peter right about now. Here's Dave Cole, looking back on his life.
In Julius Caesar, William Shakespeare suggests that the evil that men do lives after them, the good is oft interred with their bones. If that is the case, the coffin of the late Fred Phelps will be light indeed. Phelps was, of course, the patriarch of the Westboro Baptist Church, most of whose members are part of his family, a family described as the most hated in America. The WBC were best known for picketing funerals, often of military personnel, with a series of brightly coloured signs that said, "God hates," and then the name of the target of opprobrium du jour. The list is fairly impressive. Jews, Catholics, Mormons, Muslims, atheists, Hindus, any Protestant who doesn't agree with the WBC, Australians, Swedes, the Irish, Ronald Reagan, Mr. Rogers and Bill O'Reilly, just to name a few. US service personnel were a particular target, and homosexuals and homosexuality the object of hatred, and it was the protesting of military funerals that brought most attention to the WBC. It is very difficult to separate Fred Phelps from his church. Phelps has made, of late, relatively few media appearances, perhaps not surprising given his age, but we do know some things about him. Remarkable as it may seem, Phelps started off his professional career as a civil rights lawyer in Kansas, arguing for black clients in racial discrimination cases. It would seem, though, that while he appears to have overplayed his importance, he did actually make a contribution and was recognised for that by a local chapter of the NAACP. Predictably enough, standing up for blacks in the South in the 60s made a lot of enemies for Phelps. His religious beliefs let him see that opposition as proof that he was on the right track. He had opened his church as a satellite of another Baptist church in Topeka in 1955. That church would soon break ties with its mother, the Eastside Baptist. In 1991, Phelps and company started picketing a local park that they believed was being used for homosexual activity. Their specific phrase was "taken over by sodomites." Their protests, loud, direct and unpleasant, were similar to what we know the WBC for today. Unsurprisingly, they brought criticism, if not for the message, then for the medium. Phelps would picket outside local businesses that he believed employed gay people, and later started protesting funerals of people he believed had died of AIDS. They would first come to significant national attention for picketing the funeral of Matthew Shepard, a young gay man who was tortured and murdered in a prolonged homophobic attack. As before, opposition was, for Phelps, justification. Phelps was permanently banned from practicing law in Kansas in 1979. His single-mindedness in pursuing a goal had led him to attempt to destroy a witness in court. As the Kansas Supreme Court would describe it, quote, "The trial became an exhibition of a personal vendetta by Phelps against Caroline Brady. Examination was replete with repetition, badgering, innuendo, belligerence, irrelevant and immaterial matter, evidencing only a desire to hurt and destroy the defendant. The jury verdict didn't stop the onslaught of Phelps. He was not satisfied with the hurt, pain and damage he had visited on Caroline Brady. End quote. Phelps filed an appeal to this case on the basis that he had witnesses to present who would support his line of attack. It turned out that none of them had been contacted by him, and the affidavits he claimed to have did not exist. For this he was debarred in Kansas. None of this would have come as a surprise to residents of Topeka. A series of lawsuits for defamation, allegations about lawmakers and other prominent people opposed to Phelps would be spread around. Phelps would fight his corner by any and all means at his disposal. It should be said that Phelps and his actions did raise issues of polemic and perhaps of importance, but as has been said, it is a fair summary of liberty to say that it has been won in cases involving not very nice people. Over the years, the Westboro Baptist Church has won a series of legal victories and substantial amounts of money, keeping their organisation both financially afloat and in the headlines. The question behind it is, of course, why? Why would anybody want to behave in such a hateful manner? The Westboro Baptist Church describes itself as being a primitive Baptist church. Amongst its various heterodox tenets, it does hold to the 5 points of Calvinism. These are total depravity, otherwise known as original sin, unconditional election, God has chosen who is going to be saved, and that's it, limited atonement, Jesus died only for those God had chosen, irresistible grace, if God decides to save someone, then they're going to be saved, and perseverance of the saints. Those who stop believing either never believed or will have to repent. In short, what you were going to do on earth made no difference to what was going to happen to you. As far as I can make out, it was because, per Phelps, it was what God wanted in and of itself, and because they had to tell other people they were hellbound, that they protested in the particular manner and with the particular messages that they did and had. And I cannot pretend that it makes very much sense to me. We found out that Fred Phelps was near death from his estranged son, Nate Phelps. As is well known, and mentioned previously, the great majority of the WBC's 40 or so members are related to Phelps. Family members who have left the church have effectively been cut off from their family as well. The Topeka Capital Journal, I do recommend their coverage and there'll be a link in the description, reports a few other things that we find out from Nate Phelps. Evidently, Phelps Sr. had argued for a kinder approach to church members. It is worth noting that he had been violent, according to people who have left the church, to his family. We could speculate and wonder if this was a religious change of heart or an old man who wanted to see his son before death. Either way, the church had formed a board of male elders, which first removed Shirley Phelps Roper, along the second face of the WBC, and then Phelps himself. Phelps Roper was replaced by one Steve Drain, who seems to be of increasing importance in the church and its public face. The combination of isolation, religious extremism, and familial disconnection is a noxious brew. However, it seems hard to make the case that it was the message alone that caused the rage against Phelps and the WBC. Unfortunately, homophobia, for which they're best known, is not uncommon. Jerry Falwell said, being more than just homophobic and agreeing, it would seem to me, with some of what the WBC would have said, AIDS is not just God's punishment for homosexuals, it is God's punishment for the society that tolerates homosexuals. Similarly, Pat Robertson said that pagans, abortionists, feminists, gays, lesbians, the American Civil Liberties Union and the People for the American Way were responsible for 9/11. To give more examples would be otiose. Equally, I don't think that many people particularly cared about the precise theology of the Westboro Baptist Church. Rather, it was their brazenness, their willing to cause offence, and their attacks on the military, particularly seen as a fundamental part of the nation in the US, that caused such outrage. With his death, people are talking about picketing Phelps' funeral. I cannot help but think that this is a bad idea. For one, we can sink to his level and his tactic. For another, we are basically taking revenge. More than anything, though, is that the life of this man suggests that his church welcomes the hate. What they would fear is to be ignored. Perhaps the best option available is, as far as possible, to consign Phelps to the obscurity he so richly deserves. Fred Waldron Phelps, born Meridian, Mississippi, United States of America, November 13, 1929, died Topeka, Kansas, USA, March 19, 2014. Reporting for the Pod Delusion, this is David Landon Cole.
And now here's our media correspondent, me, talking about some awful headlines this week. Over to you, James.
Say what you will about the tabloid press, but they don't half make it difficult to be someone who opposes statutory regulation of the press themselves, as proposed by the Leveson Report. Yesterday, four newspapers, the Daily Mail, the Mirror, the Daily Star and the Sun, all splashed with the suicide of Loren Scott, who was apparently the partner of Mick Jagger. All four used a photo which apparently showed Jagger as he heard the tragic news. I think we can say without a doubt this was invasive and insensitive. So it wasn't long before commentators began to point out that this might be a good example of why statutory regulation is necessary. Now, I personally count myself amongst those opposed to regulation, with my reasoning being along the lines of being incredibly nervous about the states being able to regulate speech, however seemingly abstracted this process is. Similarly, I think that any regulation is unenforceable in the modern age, and any attempt to draw a dividing line between those who are regulated and those who are not regulated would be forced to be so vague it could be used maliciously by those claiming to have been wrongs who actually haven't been. So, for example, putting small publishers and individual blogs at risk, you know, a bit like the libel laws used to do. So, having given it some thought, I'm fairly sure that this is still my opinion, even after the outrageous sensitivity shown over yesterday's news. Not to mention the long, depressing history of tabloid shenanigans that were uncovered by the Leveson Inquiry itself. So let me take you to an analogy. On the border between Egypt and Sudan, there's something of an international anomaly. Unlike every other square foot of land on Earth outside of Antarctica, this hasn't been claimed by any country. At 800 square miles large, Bir Tawal, as I'm going to pronounce it, isn't at all insignificant, but neither Egypt or Sudan, who straddle it, actually want to claim it. The reason for this goes back to a border dispute going back to the turn of the last century, when yes, it was us, the British, who messed things up by drawing international borders with a pencil and ruler. Basically, we had two goes at dividing up Egypt and Sudan. In 1899, we drew a line across the 22nd parallel, and then again in 1902 tried again, but this time we tried to factor in who actually lived there and where tribal boundaries were. As you might imagine, this line was a lot bumpier and is significantly different from the one from 3 years prior. Egypt recognises the 1899 border, which gives it a big triangular chunk of land to the east. Sudan recognises the 1902 border, which will give them the big triangular land instead. I'm calling it a triangular land because I can't pronounce the name. But the upshot of this is that it leaves the smaller Bir Tawal as unwanted by both countries' definitions of their borders. This obviously isn't an ideal situation, but both countries have chosen to accept a somewhat bad outcome, having to disavow Bir Tawal, in order to secure what they perceive as a better outcome, as in the legitimacy of their claim on the larger triangular land. Why yes, this is a torturous utilitarian argument against the Leveson proposals. So, let me put it another way. In America over the last few years, various Republican state legislatures have put forward legislation that is ostensibly designed to prevent voter fraud. This sounds like a good idea, right? You know, requiring people to bring photo ID to the voting booths should stop fraud. Unfortunately, the only real outcome of this wasn't to stop voting fraud, which was already at incredibly low levels, but the new laws ended up disenfranchising minorities, who were less likely to have the paperwork that enabled them to exercise their democratic rights. Of course, arguably in this case, that was the intention of the Republicans who passed the laws, as minorities tend to vote Democratic. But it shows how a law passed for one reason can have unintended worse outcomes. In this case, it's probably better to accept an increased risk of voter fraud for the better outcome of ensuring that everyone can vote in the first place. You can probably see where I'm going with this now. Maybe on Leveson, Jeremy Bentham had a point. Essentially, I think that the way to think about this is in terms of balancing the outcomes. And it's necessary to accept that to ensure something that's overall very good, in this case a free press that can't be constrained by the people who it's supposed to be holding to account, we have to also accept the grim reality that this means that unfortunately the press will often go too far. Holding my nose, this has been James O'Malley for the Pod Delusion. Now, are we all doomed? That's what NASA might like you to think, according to a report they published this week. But Liz Luckendorf this week thinks we should slow down, and has been looking at their flawed historical analogy. Here she is, explaining more.
We're all doomed! Or so says a NASA Goddard Space Flight Center and National Science Foundation-backed paper that has been making the rounds this week. Doomed! I'm pretty sure I'm not as smart as all the people who put this paper together, so consider this merely pot shots from the sideline on this sort of thing. The focus of some of the media on this seemed to be around the collapse of sophisticated or advanced civilizations, like the Romans or Han Dynasty in China. There are other things mentioned like growing inequality, not to mention resource exhaustion. All these things together spell out that if we continue as normal, doom! I'm going to be the first advocate of changing things, being more environmentally conscious, and reducing inequality. But I'm a bit meh about the history aspect of all this. For one, we haven't had the kind of systemic collapse in quite some time. The civilizations mentioned in the paper, at least in the media, are all pre-industrial revolution. Even more than that, they're all pre-Peace of Westphalia and French Revolution. They are, in historical terms, quite a different kettle of fish. To quote, "The fall of the Roman Empire and equally, if not more, advanced Han, Mauryan, and Gupta empires, as well as so many advanced Mesopotamian empires, are all testimony to the fact that advanced, sophisticated, complex, and creative civilizations can be both fragile and impermanent." Can we relate our modern society to these ancient and near-ancient societies? Is the inequality between a single mother and, say, Richard Branson the same as the inequality between a slave in the Roman Empire and Marcus Aurelius? I don't really know. I don't think it's feasible to tell or even a useful term of measurement. I think dragging the idea of a cycle of history, which is terribly old-fashioned, and ancient empires does a disservice to this report. There can be a lot of tearing at the fabric of this report because of it. The Han Dynasty didn't fall due to inequality and environmental catastrophes. There were complex political struggles, religious upheavals, and rebellions. Basically, it was a bit more complicated than that. Just like the Roman Empire didn't end overnight, there was a long decline there as well. Not to mention that the society that arose afterward was just as unequal. Even though all these societies were complex and interrelated, they weren't technologically or democratically on the same level as society today. I think equating them is a red herring. There was massive inequality. There were slaves and tyrants, and no way to change things other than rebellions, basically. There was also immense religious upheaval. The Han Dynasty had Taoism and the Yellow Turban Rebellion. Rome had Christianity. I'm not sure the kind of religious revivalism exists in the same way as it did. Even with the Reformation and the Thirty Years' War, most states stayed the same, as did state structures and society. What's more interesting is that the idea of revolutions can actually be misleading. A meta-historical look at the impact of revolutions, like the French Revolution, for example, show that these sort of revolutions don't actually change the fundamental structure of society. Eventually, the entrenched powers return and take over, or power vacuums are filled and the unequal structure is retained. Basically, same shit, different person in charge. What leads to long-term change and fundamental shifts in society takes time, and the grinding down of old prejudices. In short, there are no quick fixes. So maybe we're still doomed then. What's probably worse for us is that these ancient societies didn't have the just-in-time method of distribution and production, a higher rate of urban to rural population, or the reliance on infrastructure that only a fraction of the world's population understands. Where are you getting dinner if Sainsbury's is empty on a Monday night? Do you know how to grow food that will last you the winter? Most of us don't. I think these are the more worrisome problems to bring into focus, rather than propping up what is probably an already good argument with environmental issues, infrastructure, resource exhaustion, and an unruly climate. In the end, the report concludes that the same things we've known all along. Quote, collapse can be avoided and population can reach equilibrium if the per capita rate of depletion of nature is reduced to a sustainable level, and if resources are distributed in a reasonably equitable fashion. It's the same old message. Why bring ancient history into the mix? Headlines? Probably. Will it change anything? Probably not. I imagine we'll either decline like the Romans, there'll be periods of instability, and then a new culture will take our place. Or, you know, a meteor like the dinosaurs. There isn't enough incentive for us to change our behaviour. As long as there's the iPhone 27 coming out next year. Doom! This has been Liz Luttendorf for The Pod Delusion.
Now, we've talked about electric cars on this show a lot, but are they actually there yet? Are they actually any good? This week, Salim Fadli has been trying out a Nissan Leaf.
It's been a weekend affair. Nissan dropped off the vehicle on Friday night, and it was Monday morning when they took it away. I'm still trying to work out if I will miss it. I had been dreaming of such a vehicle all my life. In the kind of science fiction that I grew up with, reliance on the internal combustion engine was a sign of a primitive culture. The electric car, I believed, was just one more step towards personal flying suits and ultimately the ability to upload my consciousness into the Matrix. So yes, I was totally geeking out over having this car for a weekend. And I loved the silky smooth, silent way that it slipped into traffic. I liked the audio integration and the quality of the dashboard electronics and the sheer science fictional delight of driving the electric car that I had long since dreamed of. If I were to buy one of these things, it would theoretically be 6 times cheaper to run than my petrol car, and that's before I count London's congestion charge and road tax. But sitting behind the Leaf for the first time, it reminded me of the first time I held a mobile phone or a laptop. These were flawed technologies that let us glimpse into the not-too-distant future, and like those early gadgets, they forced me to question my assumptions about the category. We need a new automotive language. I feel particularly sorry for the presenters of Top Gear. Electric vehicles don't have any gears or gearboxes. The notion of a vehicle having gears may soon be as obsolete as a trip to the petrol station or performing a handbrake turn. Sadly for the boy racers, the handbrake too has been consigned to the dustbin of history. But for all the novelty, these joys were overshadowed by the restrictions of electric power. As sprightly as the Leaf may appear to be, it can't take you far. When it's fully charged, it has almost enough power to get me from my home in North London to the M1 Newport Pagnell service station and back again. Supposing I were to continue up the M1, I could recharge at a motorway service station. The highest capacity charging point delivers 50 kilowatts, and assuming I could find one at each stop on my journey, then I could be on the road again in about half an hour. But if I were unfortunate enough to run into the more common 3 kilowatt chargers, it would take an entire night to replenish the Leaf's batteries. In other words, these vehicles are not built for wild adventures. The Leaf is built for the workaday life, the school run and the commute. It's designed to infiltrate London's congestion charge zone without paying a fee. And in short, it's the perfect vehicle for people who lead regular, predictable lives. It does presumably appeal to a growing demographic of younger urbanites. And if you're lucky enough to live near the right kind of power infrastructure, then going electric might not be so painful. But for the rest of us in the burbs, well, I know one or two early adopters who won't mind hauling out a hefty cable and then tethering the car to the mains in a public car park. The nearest charger to my home is 20 minutes walk away, and it's in a pay-and-display car park that enforces a maximum stay of 4 hours. And that, unfortunately, nullifies the economic benefits of ditching the internal combustion engine. It's just too much hassle. But if a few of those charging stations were to pop up on my street, well, maybe I'd be telling a different story. The Leaf is a modern wonder, and it's a marvel of engineering, but so impractical for my life. While it didn't work out for me this time, I'm certain that, as with all electronic inventions, they will become more powerful, lighter, and one day, maybe even practical enough for me to want to own one. Just not this year. This is Salim Fadley for The Pod Delusion.
Now, this week in London, it was the Big Bang Fair, a big science show aimed at getting kids into science. But how did it actually go down with the kids themselves? Bethany Jenkins was there with her son, and here's her account.
As I write this, we have been home from the Big Bang Fair for about 3 hours and have packed our still grinning son off to bed. On Thursday morning, it was mentioned on Newsround on CBBC, and my seven-year-old asked if we could go. I knew that we had no particular plans for Sunday, so, imagining that all the tickets would be gone, I checked it out and incredibly booked our 3 tickets. All tickets to the event are completely free, but adults can't attend unless they have at least one child with them. The Big Bang Fair has been held annually since 2009. From their website, the Big Bang is the largest celebration of science, technology, engineering and maths for young people in the UK. Everything we do is aimed at showing young people, primarily aged 7 to 19, just how many exciting and rewarding opportunities there are out there for them with the right experience and qualifications. This year it was held at the NEC Birmingham, and last year it was at XL London. There doesn't seem to be an announcement yet about where it will be next year. It is always held in the middle of March and is part of the National Science and Engineering Week. It runs from Thursday to Sunday, with Thursday and Friday being reserved for school groups with families, and community groups also welcome on Saturday and Sunday. So we set off from near York at about 8:30 this morning, not really sure what to expect, but all quite excited. 2 hours later we pulled off the M42 and seemingly straight into a car park at the NEC. There were plenty of people around to help us work out where to go next, as the site is huge. Even the bus driver that shuttled us to the hall made sure that we knew where we had parked and made sure we didn't go into Disney on Ice by mistake. Inside the building there were people with foam fingers pointing out which way to go. There seemed to be a large crowd heading in, and I wondered whether we would get stuck in a queue for ages, but there were at least 10 lines with people halfway down handing out security passes and then people at the end scanning our printed out tickets, and within minutes we were through and free to explore as we wished. The information that we'd received before the event made it clear that the talks were being organised on a first-come, first-served basis this year, rather than having pre-bookable tickets, and the recommendation was to be at the stage an hour before the talk was due to arrive. So given the queuing ability of our son, we had decided not to do the talks as there was so much else to do. We began in the Energize section, talking to people from the British nuclear industry about their use of robots, and to his delight, Alexander was able to control a robot, which had controllable caterpillar tracks, so that it could climb up into a box. Also in this area were people from the National Grid and other power companies talking to students about careers in energy production. Persuading a reluctant child to let other people have a go with the robot, we moved on to a careers section. This started with a quiz to assess which career path might be of most interest. Visit thebigbangfair.co.uk/whosecrewareyou if you'd like to try it. The crews were split into 12 areas including power, health, technology, ideas and space, and Alexander got film and television. We then spoke to people representing the crews who were able to answer questions about their careers and to inspire the children. Off to one side was a tent with more specific career advice and inspiration for the older children. The next section was Go Global, which had stalls from the aeroplane industry. This included a small wind tunnel with wing sections to put in and turn around to watch the turbulence, with someone there to explain what was happening and why. Controlling a robot arm through a maze proved to be more tricky, but lots of fun. It was at this point that we noticed the cubicles that seemed to be placed throughout the halls. Each one had a demonstrator in it with an activity to do it. Alexander began with a hop, skip and jump experiment to see which one took him further and to talk about why. One thing that we noticed throughout the event was that everyone we spoke to listened carefully to what Alexander was saying and spent as much time as he needed to answer his questions and explain things to him. There was a wonderful section in the middle of Hall 3 with things for the children to make. Alexander made a balloon-powered car and then a jumping bean. When he'd finished the jumping bean, he was able to test it on surfaces with different textures and talk about why its movement changed. Other people seemed to be making towers as tall as they could out of paper straws which were to support a marble at the top. As we walked around, the Big Bang Fair was living up to its name as the buzz of the crowd was punctuated by enormous bangs. The next section, which took us to the bottom of the hall, was On the Move, with representatives from car companies and other travel organisations. Alexander built a car from wooden pieces which were fixed together with Velcro. It was then pulled along an obstacle track with a rubber egg in it to see whether it could support the egg and stay together. His first go wasn't too effective, but the guys running the stall discussed it with him and helped him to improve it so that it did much better on the second run. We took a quick look round the F1 in school section, but sadly the gas-powered cars weren't available to be made anymore, and the queues to try out driving an F1 car simulator were so long that we didn't wait. The project seems very interesting for older children though, and as Alexander gets older we'll try to find out more about it. The Out of This World section with people from ESA and other space projects was another busy area that we passed through but didn't linger in. I wish we'd gone there when it was quieter first thing, but we'll know for next year. In the next area, the Source, we had a fantastic demonstration of how crystals grow using marbles to represent atoms. There was an inverted pyramid filled with marbles in a regular pattern. When loose marbles were poured onto it, they built up into an uninverted pyramid on top, which they would of course, but it was a brilliant demonstration. We had a picnic with us as we weren't sure how the queues would be at any food areas. There were 3 picnic areas set up and plenty of other space around the hall to stop and take a break. The queues didn't seem to be a problem, and the food did look delicious from what we saw of people walking by with it. As I mentioned, we decided not to queue up for any of the shows, but we couldn't resist finding a spot at the edge of the hydrogen stage to see a bit of the Science of Doctor Who talk. This was a 45-minute talk split into space, time, machines and monsters, using Doctor Who as examples of various effects, including Schrodinger's cat, mentioned in discussions of the Weeping Angels. With all of the noise in the hall, I was a bit concerned that we wouldn't be able to hear very well, but the audio was clear and perfectly audible. In another of the cubicles, Alexander had a wonderful time wiring up circuits to light up bulbs, make a beeping sound and start a fan. The lady demonstrating this was brilliant and explained it also that he made some complex circuits incorporating all of the elements with switches as well. I thought he would be there all afternoon. Moving into the next hall in the Think Digital section, we tried to have a look at the Raspberry Pi stall, but it was very busy, so we moved on to the BBC stall. It was also busy, but one of their staff pointed out that there was a talk that was just ending which should make things quieter, and that there were 4 of their top cameramen demonstrating various types of cameras that the children could try out. There was also a Sherlock app to try. Given that it was busy, we decided to return later. The X plus Y area was concerned with maths and learning, with many universities having stands here. There were many wonderful activities for the older children, but not so much tailored to a 7-year-old. We might perhaps have spent more time in this section had the next section not been the VEX robotics been adjacent, and calling to Alexander's overwhelming love of robots. In the robot section there were record-breaking robots, one of which has just beaten the time taken to solve a Rubik's Cube. There were robots to control and much more besides. Some of the children were racing robots around an obstacle course with such concentration and enjoyment. Whilst we were there, no records were being challenged, but it was great to see that this was an event where such things could take place. Most of the stages were open so that people could stand or sit around them and see and hear what was going on. However, the Big Bang stage was fully enclosed, so all that we really know about it is that it was the origin of most, although certainly not all, of the tremendous bangs. We were delighted to see some bacteria art. Dick and Dom, a CBBC pair of presenters, are currently involved in a series called Absolute Genius, which celebrates a different genius each week. And one of the people they featured was Alexander Fleming. And to mark his achievements, they made pictures of themselves using bacteria, with a negative stasis being protected by antibiotics. As well as the 2 pictures they did, there were pictures of Stephen Fry, Liz Bonin and some others. The next section was the Food to Fork area, which, as the name suggests, had lots of stands about farming and food. There was a giant gut to walk through, pictures of common bacteria and many games to play to try to understand how things work and what may go wrong. This was another area that we could have spent hours in, but sadly didn't have time. The last area was the Alive section, which had large stalls by the NHS, including the paramedics. There was even an operating theatre set up so that the children could see, and some could experience, what it is like to be a surgeon, obviously not operating on real people. There was also a stall with experiments to do with how our brains work, including glasses to put on that distort vision, with a seemingly simple task to trace out the borders of a simple shape. This caused much merriment and joking as people struggled through the challenge. Once we had finished in this area, we decided to return to the BBC stand to see whether it was now any quieter. There was a new show in progress, this time being carried out by Fran Scott, who is a scientist featured on many shows on CBBC. Unfortunately, it was nearly over as we would have liked to have seen more of it, but as it came to a showy climax as Fran set fire to bubbles containing hydrogen on her own hand. Alexander was absolutely overwhelmed by seeing Fran, and when we went to talk to her, he was so excited he couldn't speak for a bit. She, like everyone else we had met, was brilliant at talking to him and managed to put him at ease so that he could talk to her about his love of science. He hasn't stopped talking about it since, and this has inspired him to greater heights of joy in the subject. That brought an end to the day in a suitably exciting way, and we made our way out of the centre. All of the way back from the halls, there were guides making sure that no one got lost and managing the traffic so that people could get to their cars safely. In conclusion, the venue was brilliant, and all the staff and volunteers manning it were very helpful. Getting there, parking, and refreshments were made easy and quick, taking potential causes of stress out of the day. Obviously, though, the day was made by the wonderful stands, activities and shows that we could have spent at least twice as long there. The people working on the stalls were all great at inspiring, informing, intriguing, as the show stated. The children, working well with children from 7 years old up to 18 years old. We will certainly be making plans to go to the event next year in March, and we'll be looking out for Big Bang events near us as well. If you don't have a child to take with you, beg, borrow or steal one. Although actually don't steal one, of course, but try to get there. So that was my point of view, but what did Alexander think? Over to Alexander.
I thought it was really good, and there was lots of stalls to try out, and there wasn't much to buy, but that was good. And all the staff were really good.
So what was your favourite bit?
Seeing Fran, I think.
So what was your favourite activity?
Actually, I don't know. There's so much to pick from.
So do you want to go again next year?
Yes, definitely.
Thank you very much, Alexander. This is Bethany Jenkins reporting for the Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to 4.5 years' worth of podcast archives. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter if you're into those sorts of things. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Dave Cole, Liz Luckendorf, Salim Fadley, Bethany Jenkins, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.